This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Patrick J. Curry. Today is July 15, 2005, and it's approximately 2:10 p.m. Central Standard Time. And Pat and I are in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, in the Special Collections Library Southwest Collection Building, and we're in the interview room, just the two of us. And we are conducting an interview for the Vietnam Oral History Project as part of the Vietnam Archive. Pat, before we begin, I've explained off the record the entirety of the interview process, and you told me that you do understand it.
I do.
And you're free, of course, to ask questions as we go. And also that you're aware that consenting to do this interview verbally here today, and we'll sign an interview agreement after we finish, but consenting to the interview now and taking part in the interview, you agree, you understand that it will be made public, and that at this point you are okay with that, and that this will be available in the archive physically here for people to listen to and read, and then also on the internet on the virtual Vietnam Archive. It'll be available to the public free of charge. Do you consent to go forward with the interview and to those standards?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Well, why don't we start? I'd like to start with where you were born and when you were born, and just a little bit about your childhood.
Well, I was born in Temple, Texas, September 25th, 1945. My father was an Army officer stationed at Fort Hood, which is real close to Temple there. And, in fact, he wasn't there when I was born. He'd been reassigned, and my mother couldn't travel. My dad was career military. He had 24 years of service, served during World War II, and was in the 1st Cavalry Division in Korea, was a prisoner of war there for 33 months.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite an experience. Interesting that he never did really talk about it until I got back from Vietnam.
Really?
And then he told me some stories and some things about what he went through, and it was educational. Scary.
Did you ask him about it beforehand? I mean, did you kind of say what happened?
Well, tried to, but he was kind of reluctant and not. He used to tell stories every now and then, but not a lot of detail. And, you know, if he had met up with one of his old friends or something like that, the only thing he really talked about was a chaplain named Capon, who was in the prisoner POW camp with him, saved his life.
Was he a South Korean or American?
Oh, he was an American.
He was an American. Okay.
And from Kansas.
Okay.
And there's a big memorial to him in Kansas. He died in the camp, but he had probably saved a large number of prisoners, giving up his own food and his own blanket and those kinds of things.
Wow.
My dad woke up one morning. He told me this story. He woke up one morning and he couldn't raise his head up off this block they used as a pillow. And he had contracted pneumonia. And he was in POW Camp 5, which was right up on the Yalu River. It was cold.
Wow.
And the chaplain came over and took care of him, nursed him, gave him his food and all that. My dad recovered. The only time I ever saw my father cry was when he went to the memorial service for Chaplain Capon after the war.
Yeah. Wow, what intense memories.
Oh, very.
Experience.
Very. And then when I got back, like I said, he told me some other stories that were pretty intense.
So he was in World War II. What did he say about his experience in that war?
Well, you know, he had kind of an interesting experience in World War II. He was never in combat. At that time, he was a Medical Service Corps officer, and he wound up running an aid station in Brazil.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, why? I never knew why we had an aid station, a medical aid station in Brazil, but that's what he did.
Okay.
During the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of those who is glad that we used the atomic bombs in Japan, because if we hadn't, I probably wouldn't be here. My dad was, as I mentioned, at Fort Hood in 1945 as an infantry officer. Certainly would have gone to the Pacific Theater to fight in the invasion of Japan.
Yes.
The casualty rates being what they were.
Yes.
Like I said, I probably wouldn't be here today. So
That's interesting perspective, and that's something that maybe many people don't think about. That those a lot of people born because people were here and not there, and not in invading the home islands.
Well, there was a history book of World War II that came out a few years ago. I can't even remember the name of it now. Mm-hmm. But on the first page, the two authors said that they were certain that nobody under the age of 60 would disagree with them when they say that dropping the atomic bombs was a big mistake and the United States shouldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. I just closed the book, set it aside, haven't looked at it since. I don't think that's history. That's personal opinion.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not one I share. Or my brothers, I might add.
It's interesting, as a teacher of history, I often, when I'm trying to pick a textbook, I'll go in and I'll open up a certain event and see how it's interpreted, and the atomic bomb is my very first one I always go to. So that's interesting that you start with that. Tell me about your dad. What kind of person was he that you remember?
He was a good guy. He came from a very rural background in rural Ohio. Mm-hmm. He lived on a farm near a very small little town, Mount Vernon, Ohio, mm-hmm. which is probably 50 miles north of Columbus. But they lived on a farm out in the country. His parents were, if you look up hillbilly in the dictionary, there are pictures there. My grandmother was married, had two kids, divorced by the time she was 16, mm-hmm. Which nowadays is kind of shocking, but, yeah. That's just the way it was.
Right.
If you weren't married by 14, you were an old maid.
Mm-hmm.
And he went into the Army Reserves in the 30s as a way to get away from this and get out of this little town and
right.
get away from that life. And then when the Army started expanding, he went into the regular Army.
Okay.
as opposed to the Reserves,
mm-hmm.
and wound up staying in it for a career. He was not a high school dropout. I think he dropped out about the 7th grade. Dropped out of school, and rural America in that time, education was not highly prized, but he finally wound up with an associate's degree.
Okay.
So he did get a little education, mm-hmm. and that was his number one priority of all time for us three.
Really?
Yeah, my two brothers and I.
Now, your brothers are older or younger?
I'm the oldest.
Okay.
I've got another brother, Dave, who he went on to get a PhD from UT in chemistry. He's a research geochemist for Exxon. And my other brother is a warrant officer in the Coast Guard.
Okay.
And he is assigned in Michigan right now.
Okay.
But the education was the thing for my dad. He perceived that if you didn't have an education, you were not going anywhere.
And, right.
So we were going to get one.
Right.
And like I say, Korea was a pretty scary time. We lived with my mother's parents, who were also farmers, in Illinois.
Okay.
And, of course, where they live now is houses and Walmarts and
right.
all that kind of thing. At that time, it was out in the country.
And is that where, I'm sorry to interrupt, is that where you kind of remember growing up, or did you all move around a lot?
Well, we moved around a lot, but we stayed in Rockford, Illinois for over 3 years, and that's really kind of what I remember the earliest.
Okay.
Is living on a farm, and my grandmother had six daughters, so I had plenty of cousins
yeah.
to play with, and it was a real sense of family. And then when my dad came back and we moved off again, then of course that was kind of broken, but
mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's kind of that's how I perceive myself as having been raised.
Okay. Okay. Tell me about your mother. What was she like?
My mom's parents immigrated from Sicily, and not Italy.
Right.
Sicily.
Oh yeah, Sicily.
You don't call my grandfather Italian unless you wanted to fight. And he was a great old guy. Spoiled us to death. But my mom grew up on a farm, and it's the old cliche, walk 3 miles through the snow to school.
Mm-hmm.
She was the only one of the six sisters and one brother who ever went to college. And she finished college.
Was this in Ohio?
No, this was in Illinois.
In Illinois.
Yeah, my dad's folks were from Ohio, and my mother's folks were from Illinois.
Okay.
And they met while my dad was on recruiting duty in Rockford, Illinois.
Okay.
And so that's how my parents met.
Okay.
And but my mom got her college degree and taught school, and I remember her teaching in a school where she had four grades in one classroom.
Wow.
And you don't see much of that anymore, but she actually did that. And so we lived there through the Korean War. It was obviously a very tough time for her. And
yes.
We went months and months and months and didn't know whether my dad was alive or not.
Do you remember? You remember that?
Oh yeah.
You were what, 8, 7?
6, 7, 8. Yeah.
Tell me about the Korean War. What do you remember? Are those your first kind of big world type memories?
Yeah, they really are. And I remember watching the president on television and that kind of thing. And of course, I remember the big events.
Did you see Truman or did you see Eisenhower?
Yes.
On TV? It was both of them?
Both
really?
Of them.
Okay.
And God, I'm old.
Well, that's really neat that you were able to touch history in that sense as a young man, see Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower there.
Well, my mother bought my grandparents their first television. You know, the little black and white with the snowy screen.
Yes.
And we had about a 60-foot antenna on top of the house. And we were
60-foot antenna. Wow.
And, we were way out in the country outside of a relatively small town.
Right.
And we had we were state-of-the-art. We had a fancy gadget. It was a little electric box where you could turn, and it would electrically turn the antenna to point it towards the television station.
Uh-huh.
So every time you wanted to change a station, you had to get up and turn the antenna to face that station so you could get reception.
That's neat.
And so we were first in the neighborhood. We actually had a television.
Wow.
And went from there. And
you remember watching this TV. Is this at your grandparents' house?
My grandparents' house, my mother's folks.
Okay. And, tell me about your memories of the Korean War. I know that it was probably touched very personally because your father was in it. Were you aware your dad is fighting in Korea across the world?
Well, you know, in the sense that a seven-year-old is,
yes.
I knew he was a long way away and that he was in a war. And I kind of had a vague notion of what that was.
Yes.
And I knew after he got captured and everything that you know, it was not a good situation, and we didn't know whether he's going to come home or not.
They told you he was captured.
Well, yes, okay. Finally. Okay. Finally, the Red Cross got word from the North Koreans that he was a prisoner.
Okay.
And this is after quite a few months where, like I say, we didn't know whether he was alive or dead.
He was infantry?
He was Medical Service Corps at that time, but he was the medical officer for an infantry battalion, or infantry regiment, actually,
okay.
At that time. The 8th Cavalry Regiment and the 1st Cav Division,
okay.
Which I was in the 1st Cav in Vietnam, which I thought was kind of neat.
I noticed when you said that, I remember that you were in the same division.
Yeah, and I remember my mother was Catholic. My grandparents, of course, coming from Sicily, were Catholic. And so we had a little altar set up, and every night we'd kneel down and say our prayers and wish that he would come home. And he was with the 1st Cav, and right at the beginning of the war, well, not the beginning, but after a few months when the Chinese came into the war and just rolled south like a wave, they overran the 1st Cav, in fact, captured the division colors. And he was, as an infantry, being as he was with an infantry unit, he was among those that was overrun. And he told me he went to sleep 5 miles behind the lines one night and woke up 5 miles behind the lines on the other side the next morning.
Wow.
I mean, they came through that fast.
Wow. Did he tell you how he was captured?
He said that they pretty much, as the Chinese came through, he said there were so many of them, it was just incomprehensible. said the joke was how many hordes in a Chinese platoon. The Chinese soldiers in back didn't even have weapons. They were expected to pick up weapons from their dead comrades as they moved forward.
Incredible.
And so their unit, my dad's unit, just got fragmented, and he was in a hut.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this was at night, and the next morning, he said he had woken up and he was looking out through this shell hole in the side of this hut, and he turned around and there was a North Korean soldier with a rifle, and that's how he got captured.
Hmm. Did he talk about how he was treated?
He said that the North Koreans were SOBs, that he'd be laying there, and while he was being moved to POW camp, he'd be in a cell or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd come through and prod him with a rifle butt or reach in and twist his nose, keep him awake all night.
Mm-hmm.
Just cruel things.
Mm-hmm.
But he said the Chinese were different. He said they were a little more humane. And mm-hmm. He said they pretty much ate what the guards at the POW camp ate. If the guards had rice, they had rice. And
right.
That he's not a big fan of the Chinese, but for obvious reasons. But he said they were certainly far preferable to the North Koreans.
Wow. Does that affect your view of the North Koreans today?
Oh, I'm sure it does. Yeah, I don't see how it couldn't.
I know.
I think that the leader over there is certifiable, and he scares me to death with nuclear weapons, because there's just no telling what he's going to do. I mean, if he'll fire a missile over Japan, I just...
Yeah. Okay. So, your parents meet, and did they talk about where they came from as people, kind of what their values were? How did you all learn about life from them? What do you remember about them kind of teaching you lesson-wise?
You know, one thing I really remember is my mom, being an Italian Catholic, at that time, she talked about walking down the street after she got out of school looking for a job and mm-hmm. seeing signs that Catholics need not apply. They'd interview her and find out she was Catholic, wouldn't hire her, those kinds of things.
Wow.
And that made a pretty big impact on me and my brothers. And I think that affects us to this day.
What'd you think?
I thought that was so wrong. How can you judge somebody because they're Catholic? You don't know anything about them.
Right.
And that's just not right. I just can't think of a different way to put it. And I'm pleased to say that Diane and I were able to pass that on to our kids, and they feel much the same way.
Okay.
And so I think that's a good value to have, and that's, you talk to that.
Talk about education.
Okay. Education. Talk about values. Do it right. My dad always believed if you're going to do it right, do it all the way, or don't do it.
Right.
You know, don't, if you'll pardon the expression, don't do it half-assed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, either do it all the way or don't do it at all. And,
right.
And again, in my two brothers and I can see that with all of us.
As the oldest, did your parents expect more from you?
Always, especially my dad.
Did they tell you that?
No, I can't say that they came out and said that in words. And I'm not sure so much my mother, but my dad definitely. And I think, you know, you got a father with an oldest son. I think he expects more of that oldest
mm-hmm.
son.
Mm-hmm.
And which is not to say that I always lived up to what he expected. But,
sure.
But yeah, he definitely did.
What ethnicity was your father, did you say?
He was Irish descent.
Okay.
Yeah, but, I mean, and we've tried to track it back, and we can go back to his father, and after that it just gets lost. And, I mean, they were from the deep south, essentially illiterate. My grandfather was illiterate, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, there's just not a lot of written records
right.
and sure. those kinds of things.
Okay. I want to know what you were like as a little boy. What do you remember about yourself? Were you curious? Were you active? Or were you quiet?
God, I was the neighborhood wimp. I mean, everybody picked on me. You know, the kid who the big kids would steal the ball, that was me. It was my ball. And I had a a real active imagination, had a lot of imaginary friends and pets and all that kind of stuff. And my mother taught English, so we were always around books. My father would read. I mean, he would sit at the breakfast table and read the cereal box. He just read and read and read and read and read. And of course, my mom, I'd say English teacher, there were always books around, and and all of us read from the earliest age, and I think that probably created a lot of imagination in all three of us.
Right. So you remember reading?
Oh, yeah. Tom Swift, all of them. Okay. Hardy Boys, all of them. All of those.
Okay. Your brothers as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what kind of people they were? Do you remember them growing up?
Oh, gosh. My youngest brother, Bart, is 9 years younger than I am.
Okay.
And he is I'm a World War II baby. He's a Korean War baby.
Right.
And so we really never, just about the time he was getting old enough to develop a real personality, I left the house. And we never really got close until actually when I retired from the Army and came back to Texas and settled down. Mm-hmm. And then he and I got kind of close again. And I guess the same is essentially true with my middle brother, Dave. Dave is so damn smart that it's just hard to describe. Mm-hmm. He has an eidetic memory, and he can read a book and then 5 years later tell you which side of the page a certain paragraph was on.
Wow.
Yeah, he just never forgets anything. And I mean, he was the 4.0 all the way through school and all the way through grad school, and I was not that way. It's to put it charitably, I had a checkered academic career.
Well, tell me about school for you. What did you like or dislike about it? And what do you remember about going to school?
Boy, I had a lot of fun in college, which is probably why it took me 12 years to get my degree.
So you're starting in college. Tell me about your elementary school. What do you remember about that?
Well,
yeah, what kind of, were you a young boy who just dreaded going to school every day?
No. I liked the school part. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I got picked on a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I got along with my teachers. I got really good grades. You know, honor roll and all that kind of good stuff. My mouth got me in trouble a lot. I talked a lot. And
this is like pre-junior high, high school?
Yeah, we're talking fifth, sixth grade.
Okay.
And I was in school at Fort Sam Houston.
Mm-hmm.
After the Korean War, my dad came back. He had been shot in the arm, and it had carried pieces of his field jacket into his arm that he had carried around with him for a little over 3 years.
Wow.
And so they had to do surgery on his arm.
Mm-hmm.
And as a Medical Service Corps officer, Fort Sam is the home of the Medical Service Corps, so he was reassigned there to get taken care of medically, and then he stayed on. So I was going to school there.
Okay.
And I always thought it was a pretty good school. And like I said, I did well. For seventh grade, my dad went to Japan. And this was 56, 57.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Japan. But we still had an occupation force at that time. And so he went over there. And while he was waiting for housing for us to come over,
mm-hmm.
we went to school at a place called Wig Hill School in Rockford, Illinois. Went back, stayed with my mother's parents again.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely the hellhole of the earth.
Also,
I just did not fit in at all. I was used to being around military kids, mm-hmm. and I kind of knew what that was like, and I got out to this school and this farm community, and I just did not fit in, and I got a really rough time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just would get up in the morning, go to school, and my stomach would hurt. Any excuse to stay home, any excuse not to go to school. And finally the principal called me in and talked to me, and just a great guy. I mean, here I was, one among all these kids, and he not only knew something was wrong, but wanted to do something about it, mm-hmm. and just really helped me out.
Mm-hmm.
Let me know I wasn't completely alone.
Mm-hmm.
And So, but boy, I hated it.
How long did you stay there?
Oh, fortunately, just a few months.
Okay.
And thank heavens, or I probably lost my mind. But then my dad got quarters, and we moved to Japan.
Wow.
Lived in a Japanese house, and I'm talking straw floors, paper walls.
And you're in, what, seventh?
Seventh grade.
Wow.
And what it was of course, Japan was still recovering from the war. I mean, it had only been 12 years. And
where were you? Do you remember what city?
Yes, we were in Tokyo, and we lived in a suburb called Setagayaku.
Do you know how that's spelled?
Not a clue.
For the sake of our transcriptionist, but that's okay. We'll figure that out.
Yeah, sorry, not a clue.
Okay. Can you say it again?
Setagayaku.
Setagayaku. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And our landlord had taken his house, built a wall down the middle, and then added on an American-style living room that had a hardwood floor and glass windows and those kinds of things. And but the bedrooms, the kitchen, the bathroom were all Japanese style.
Hmm.
And so, like I say, we had the straw mats on the floor, tatami, and shoji, which are the sliding paper doors. And every morning, we would walk. My brother and I would walk, I don't know, quarter of a mile, half a mile down to the bus stop. You'd always see Mount Fuji in the background. You know, that perfect cone.
Sure.
Just absolutely beautiful. It just dominated the skyline. And so I went to Yoyogi High School, and that's Y-O-Y-O-G-I. And I did 7th and 8th grades there. And then we finally got government quarters and moved to a place called Grant Heights, which was kind of way out. And then finally got back into Tokyo and moved into Washington Heights.
Okay.
And had a nice little house there. We were trying to help the Japanese economy. And so we had a full-time maid for $18 a month.
Wow.
And neighbors were mad because we overpaid her. I think the going rate was about $15. And they actually, the Army had set up a little secure compound where these young women lived. Mm-hmm. And they would come out and be maids during the day. Then at night, they would go back. And
is this a house or an apartment?
Ours was a house.
Okay. Uh-huh. What was it like for you to go to Japan at such a young age? I mean, this is really very unique for, and I was going to ask you about, you know, growing up in the 1950s America, and here you are, you've gone to Japan.
I did, and it was one of the things that about Japan, especially at that time, that was so different from the United States. Mm-hmm. And obviously a lot of similarities between Europe and the United States, but at that time very few similarities between Japan and the United States. It was just really different and very exotic and interesting. And
what year was this?
This was, we went in 57,
okay,
and we were in Japan. And my dad was stationed at Camp Drake, which was in downtown Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
It was the big hospital in Tokyo. If you went out the front gate and turned left, you were staring at the Imperial Palace.
Wow. Right there in the middle.
Right there in the middle of town.
Okay.
And the big moat around the palace,
right,
and the whole works.
Right.
And
so 57, and how long was it?
We were there for almost 2 years, okay, and then they started phasing things out in Japan, downsizing U.S. forces, and we moved to Okinawa. And we moved to Okinawa in, gosh, late 58.
Okay.
And I went to Kubasaki High School. K-U-B-A-S-A-K-I. And which I understand is still there, but I don't know for sure.
Tell me before we leave,
sure,
mainland Japan, mm-hmm, about the Japanese people and their recovery from World War II and their personalities, their culture. Just what do you remember about that?
They were so friendly and so nice.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it kind of did. But I mean, you know, I was seventh grade. You know,
sure,
I didn't do a lot of deep introspection. But
right.
But I, you know, even at that age, I knew, you know, we'd won the war, they were conquered, how nice were they going to be? But, I mean, they're just very, very nice people. In fact, we had a maid named Toshiko who was just super. And we tried to talk her into coming back to the United States with us.
Really?
And, you know, for the opportunities that she was like a member of the family.
Right.
But she didn't want to leave her parents, who were older, and she didn't want to leave them. We have to understand that. But we had some Japanese friends. The our landlord in the Japanese house, very nice people. They had a teenage son, and he came over and got me one day. He spoke about as much English as I do Japanese, which is to say none.
You did not learn Japanese?
No. Okay. No, that was not encouraged in those days.
Really?
Yeah, it was really kind of a separation.
Because you went to school, I'm sure, there. I mean, it was an English-speaking school.
It was an American school.
Yes.
Yeah, run by the armed forces.
Yes.
Yeah, it was totally like, as far as school is concerned, no difference than being in the United States.
Right. What did this kid do?
Well, he came over and got me one day, and, you know, all sign language and everything, and went over to his side of the house. Of course, you take your shoes off, and went in. He had the most amazing insect collection.
Huh.
And I remember it to this day. And that was more than just last week. But, I mean, it was amazing. He had case after case after case of all kinds of insects, beetles and butterflies and just all kinds of things that, from the little that we could communicate, I gathered he had put together for school.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just an amazing collection.
Wow.
And he came over, he was real proud of it, showed it to us and everything.
Do you remember any feelings of resentment or awkwardness with the Japanese people?
Not any. In fact, one of the things we used to do was there was a big park near our house.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go down there and play baseball with the Japanese kids. The Japanese love baseball.
Nice.
I mean, they are insane about baseball. And we would go down there and play baseball with the Japanese kids for hours and hours.
Mm-hmm.
We never had any of you can't play or there's no place on the team for you or none of that.
Wow.
I always wondered how they were hitting the ball so far. Well, then I found out they use a hard rubber baseball.
Oh, okay.
And you can knock that sucker a mile.
Uh-huh. That made fun.
Yeah.
Challenging.
You could really get some hits.
Yeah.
So, but no, I don't. I really honestly don't remember any incidents. Now, the exception being on May 1st, May Day, big communist holiday,
yes,
we had to stay home, indoors, shades drawn, curtains closed, doors locked. Because of the Japanese, because of the communist demonstrations and all of that on May 1st.
Okay.
But I don't recall that we ever had anything directly against us.
What about Reconstruction? Did you see any of that? Or did you notice, I guess, at that young age, you know, buildings, you know, damaged somehow? I mean, we're talking 10 years plus after the war.
No, not really. I'm sure that out in the countryside, there was still damage, or in some of the smaller cities maybe, but Tokyo had been pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Ginza was very brightly lit, all neon, and Tokyo had been, at least the parts we saw, had been pretty well reconstructed, rebuilt by that time.
What do you think about the Japanese today? Does that, I mean, I know that shapes your you lived there for 2 years, and then you were going to talk about Okinawa, but when you think of the Japanese today as this economic superpower and so plugged into everything the United States is doing, what's your opinion of Japan? And do you see similarities?
I think the Japanese and the Germans are kind of the ugly Americans of the 90s, 80s and 90s. Some interesting experiences in Europe outside of Germany with German people. But I think they've gotten, you know, much like I think we did in the 50s and 60s, got a little arrogant, a little bit of, you know, we did this economic miracle, and so we're a little smarter than the average bear, and et cetera. So.
What do you remember about Japanese-Chinese relations back then?
Not a thing.
Okay.
Yeah, just way over my head. Okay. We did have one friend, and his nickname was Popeye. I never did find out what his real name was.
Japanese friend?
He was actually Chinese.
Oh, okay.
And had, he said, been on the last boat from mainland China in 1948 when Shang fled to Taiwan, yes. Formosa.
Yes.
And so he had gotten out just in time, came to Japan to make his fortune, and, wow. and apparently had done so. Uh-huh. And he and my dad somehow got to be real good friends.
Okay.
He had a daughter about my age, a very attractive girl.
Uh-huh.
And of course, the wife, she hardly ever said a word. But,
right.
Very quiet.
It's an interesting experience. Before we move forward, I wanted to ask you. You mentioned Truman and Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
What are your opinions of those two presidents? Very different gentlemen.
Very, very different. Actually, got to see Eisenhower in person on Okinawa.
Really?
If you can believe that, he was on some kind of tour of the Far East mm-hmm. And came through. I liked Truman, even given that I think 25% of what we see and hear about him now is probably hyperbole. I liked him because I think he was an honest man
mm-hmm.
and a straightforward man. I a little less favorable opinion of Eisenhower. I kind of have an opinion of him as more of a do-nothing, more of a little reluctant to move, a little hesitant to move
mm-hmm.
and do things.
Mm-hmm. Was there any talk in your household that you remember, households around the world, where you were, of your dad talking about MacArthur and Truman and that controversy?
My dad and I on one side and my middle brother on the other, my dad thought MacArthur was a horse's patootie. That that Truman should have fired him out of hand for insubordination. That MacArthur did great, wonderful things during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
He did good things in Korea, but he's not the president. And the military is subject to the president. And if the president says, do this, you do it.
It's the issue of civilian control of the
exactly.
military.
Exactly. And I agree with my dad. Truman should have looked him in the eye, realizing he couldn't because of the political implications.
Right.
But wishing that he could, looked him in the eye and fired him out of hand.
And your brother?
My brother disagrees. He thinks that MacArthur's approach was right, so that MacArthur had a right to disobey Truman. And I disagree. It doesn't matter whether Truman was right or wrong. He was president.
Mm-hmm.
And MacArthur is a military man. He had no choice but to obey. Should have had no choice but to say yes,
right.
sir.
And it makes it even more interesting if your father saw in a POW camp up there on the Chinese border where MacArthur was advocating, you know, basically make it a glowing border, drop nuclear weapons and,
yep.
and make it a radiation zone, as he called it,
yep.
Or radiation belt. I mean, that has implications on your dad. I mean, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, you moved to Okinawa.
Moved to Okinawa in late 58 or early 59.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad had kind of an interesting military career. He had come in as an enlisted man, went to officer candidate school in Kansas during the Second World War, became an officer. In 1948, as a reserve officer, the writing was kind of on the wall
mm-hmm.
that, you know, as the Army was downsizing so rapidly,
mm-hmm.
That guys who had come in through the enlisted chain were not going to last long. And there's a dual system. You can be a reserve Army officer on active duty and have, at that time anyway, an enlisted regular Army rank.
Mm-hmm.
So there were, in essence, two armies with two sets of ranks.
Right.
Well, they offered the regular Army NCOs a chance to revert to their regular Army grade and stay on active duty,
mm-hmm.
or they could keep their officer grade and take a chance, what the Army calls a RIF, reduction in force.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad elected to go ahead and revert to his regular Army grade, which was Sergeant First Class, E7. So he went back and became an NCO again. That lasted about 2 years, and when the Korean War started and the buildup started, he got his reserve commission was reactivated, so he became an officer again.
That's interesting. We'll flip flop there.
So, as a reserve officer at that time, you could only stay on active duty for 20 years. Well, he hit his active duty Army reserve 20 years on Okinawa. Mm-hmm. So he reverted back to NCO again.
Huh.
Wow. Rather than retire,
right,
he reverted back to E7.
Mm-hmm.
And but when he retired 4 years later, he retired as a field grade officer major,
okay,
as his reserve rank.
Okay. So was there any chance, I mean, was there a danger, I guess, of him leaving Okinawa when he reverted back to NCO again?
No, the money situation, the budget situation in the Army at that time was so tight that if there wasn't some real compelling reason, he just didn't move.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How long were you there at Okinawa?
2.5 years.
On Okinawa. Okay.
Two and a half years.
So it was 61?
Came back in 61.
Yeah. Okay. And is this where you attended high school?
No, that was junior high school, ninth and 10th grades.
Okay.
And so I said, I went to Kubasaki.
Mm-hmm.
And
and again, a military university.
Military school, yeah. It was at Okinawa town of Naha, which was NAHA, which was the capital of the Ryukyu Islands, and really interesting. I mean, at that time, even as a kid, you could go anywhere on the island. We used to ride the buses all over. There was not danger or anything like
really?
That. Yeah,
and of course, there's got to be unexploded ordnance around
all over the place,
and you could go. Just explore.
Go explore anywhere.
Wow.
In fact, I was a good friend of mine from school. His dad was in the Air Force, so he lived in a different place, but we went to the same school. And one night, his neighbors told me this story. Or one day he didn't come to school. We were wondering why.
Mm-hmm.
And he had amassed a huge unexploded ordnance collection in his bedroom. and he had been going all over the place picking all this stuff up.
Uh-huh.
And his parents found out about it, and they just evacuated the house, called the military police, who called it EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, who came out, evacuated the neighborhood, and cleaned out his bedroom.
Wow. Now, did you do any exploring?
No. We explored all over, but I didn't pick any
nothing
of
like that.
No.
What about the Okinawan people? What do you remember about them?
God, they were poor. They're not so much now, but boy, at that time, I mean, they were poor, poor people. Mm. Fishermen, subsistence level farming. I mean, as far as I know, friendly people.
Mm-hmm.
Not as much contact, for me anyway, with the Okinawans as I had with the Japanese. I mean, we had lived in a Japanese community. We didn't do that in Okinawa. Mm-hmm. We lived right on the military base, et cetera. But, so I don't feel like I knew them quite as well.
Okay.
But interesting place. Old medieval castles on the island that you could walk to.
Mm-hmm.
But very poor people. You know, you talk about the unexploded ordnance. One of the things that happened there was some fishermen were trying to open an unexploded 1,000-pound bomb. They were trying to get the explosive out. You fish with explosives. And I mean, if that's your livelihood and that's
sure.
The difference between starving to death and eating, then sure. That's what you do. And they were trying to get it open and exploded and killed several people.
Hmm. What were the major differences between the Okinawans and the Japanese, or Japan and Okinawa?
Gosh, the standard of living. I mean, even that soon after the war, we lived in Japan in basically a middle-class Japanese neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
The houses were you know, nice houses, and I mean, all the streets were paved, and even though the sewage system was two ditches 18 inches wide, and maybe 18 inches deep running alongside the road.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a decent standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
Even though in Japan, Americans at that time could not drink the water. We had to boil all our drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
But Okinawa was very, very poor. And in a lot of, I mean, outside of a military base, you know, you have the strip with bars and mm-hmm. that kind of thing, and that was pretty prevalent on Okinawa.
Okay.
And,
tell me about your schooling. Did you, first of all, miss American schools?
Well, we were in American schools. I mean, it was like I say, right. It was no different than going to school in the United States,
right.
Until you went off base. And the crowds at football games were not very big. we really didn't know the difference.
What about your favorite subjects and your least favorite subjects? What were you good at?
God, I was horrible at math. Anything having to do with math, which is funny because Diana is a math major. She's got a degree in math.
Diana, your wife?
My wife, yeah. She got a degree in math.
Uh-huh.
But I always liked history. And I liked English English literature is what I'm trying to say here. You know how you have odd memories that stand out for no particular reason? Our English teacher made us memorize Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. And we had stand up in class and recite it. And please don't ask me why I remember that, because I do not have a clue. But I remember.
Is that in Japan or in Okinawa?
That was in Okinawa.
Okay.
Yeah. And I really remember very little about school in Japan. But Okinawa, of course, you know, high school, you get.
Sure.
Junior high and high school, you get a little more aware.
What about sports?
Never. Swim team.
Okay.
Swim team.
In both places or?
Just in Okinawa.
Okay.
Well, you know, when you live on an island that's 70 miles long and 2 miles wide,
sure.
There's not a lot else to do but go to the beach.
Right.
And so I learned how to swim pretty well.
Okay.
Swim team, but you know, I'm a klutz, mm-hmm. not real coordinated, and you know, I like the chess club. I'm one of those kind of guys.
Okay.
You know, okay. I like the chess club. I like the photography club.
Right.
Didn't do the basketball team so well. Tried, but not there for me.
Okay. Your brothers and your dad. And your mother, for that matter, were they athletic? Were they into sports, or was this kind of
family? It's in my DNA. Of course, my dad never had the opportunity.
Right.
You know, he was worried as a kid about where his next meal was coming from, not about the football team. My middle brother played quite a bit of football.
Mm-hmm.
And my youngest brother, gosh, he boxed. He was a fencer. He was a wrestler. And he played football. Oh, and lifted weights.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were the pretty big exception there.
I was. Yeah. When it came to athletics, I certainly was. And and I tried out for a basketball team several times, but played a little league baseball and that kind mm-hmm. of stuff, but never well.
Right. So you're there 9th and 10th grade in Okinawa, and do you come back to the United States after that?
Came back to the United States, and my father got a reserve component assignment, mm-hmm. working with the reserves as an advisor, in Wheeling, West Virginia.
Wow, that's a big change.
Big change. I will never forget coming over the hill into Wheeling, West Virginia, which is a steel town. And, of course, everything is covered with about 6 inches of steel mill grime. And it was just cloudy day. I mean, I remember it vividly.
Mm-hmm.
Cloudy day, come over that hill, and there's this black and gray town. God, you just wanted to go somewhere and open a vein. It was the most depressing thing I had ever seen in my life. I had just come from two and a half years of sunshine and beaches,
mm-hmm.
and to come over this hill and see that below me was just, I mean, you could feel, and it just got so quiet in the car. You could tell everybody was thinking the same thing.
Right. And you're, as a teenager, I mean, that's got to be tough.
Turned out to be two of the best years of my life, and certainly the two best up to that point.
Good. When you were overseas, did you miss the United States, or was it just kind of an adventure?
I really didn't. It was really kind of an adventure, and all my mom's folks thought that she was nuts for dragging us all over the world. it really was an adventure. Even at that age, I think we had some sense of doing things that most kids don't get to do.
Mm-hmm. Before we talk about Wheeling today, on Pat today. What does Pat today think about your experience overseas? Was it for the better?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely no question about it. I've lived overseas for 13 years of my life. And, boy, there's no question it was just a fantastic experience. And even though moving around is hard on kids,
sure.
And it was hard on my kids, but we got to see and do things that is so far outside most kids' imagination even, that, it was great. It was great. Okay. And even though it was hard on my kids, I am really glad that they got to live overseas for 8 years, and they are too.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many kids do you have?
I have two daughters.
Okay.
Two daughters.
All right. What are their ages right now?
Lynn is 35 and Kathy is 32.
Okay.
And we have three grandkids now. Our oldest grandson, John, died of complications of diabetes about 4 years ago.
I'm sorry.
Didn't know if I was going to make it or not.
Mm.
But wow. But we did, and he's still with us.
Yeah.
So, okay. So we have three grandkids now. Kathy, my youngest daughter, has two girls. And my oldest daughter, she's a single mom. And she has Brendan, our grandson. He's 7 going on 8.
Okay.
And he is hell on wheels.
Well, tell me about Wheeling and these two great years.
We moved into the town of Wheeling, mm-hmm. and in a older house,
mm-hmm.
that was essentially falling apart. And my parents pretty soon decided this was not going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
So they found a really nice house, a brick house, in a town outside of Wheeling. I'm sure it's a suburb now, but at that time it was way out,
mm-hmm.
Called Glendale. And it was just a kind of a middle-class community, just mostly residential.
Is that G-L-E-N-N?
And not just one N. G-L-E-N-D-A-L-E.
Okay.
And so they rented that house, and I went to high school up the road in another steel town, Benwood, West Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and went to Union High School, and I can tell you that the movie American Graffiti is true.
Okay.
I mean...
How so?
It was exactly like that. I mean, we didn't pull rear axles off of police cars. We wouldn't have dared.
Right.
But, it was... going to the drive-in... we had driving in town, walking everywhere we went, never had to worry about were we safe or,
mm-hmm.
you know, was there a predator out there to get us. It was really kind of an idealized,
mm-hmm.
Going to the football games on Friday night, really cold. And it gets really cold in West by God, Virginia. Just freezing to death sitting there watching the football games, mm-hmm. and going to the basketball games, and this was Glendale was fairly affluent, but the other towns where the high school was Benwood, there was another McMeekin. They were steel towns and relatively poor,
mm-hmm.
towns. And mm-hmm. There was, I don't know that anybody even in school even noticed. Just all the high school cliches you hear about going to high school in the 60s. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, this was before drugs and all
right.
that kind of stuff. And,
right. This is 61, 62, 63.
Yeah, 61 to 63. My girlfriend wore my class ring around her neck on a string. it was a small school. I guess we had about 350 kids all together.
Mm-hmm.
There were 60 kids in my graduating class, but Dave Miner got an empty envelope. He had to go to summer school to finish, but they let him walk.
Okay.
And so 59 of us actually graduated.
Were you a good student?
I was an excellent student. And it was funny, my first 2 years in Okinawa,
mm-hmm.
if I was lucky, C's, mostly D's, went to Benwood, straight A's, at most A's and B's. Don't think I ever got a C while I was there.
What changed?
No clue. No clue. I maybe it was because I had found a group of good friends, mm-hmm. similar interests, etc. Mm-hmm. But I really, and I've often wondered that. And if you think I wondered, you should have seen my parents.
I bet they were ecstatic.
What happened? Right. They weren't asking too many questions.
Right,
though.
Right.
But yeah, I did very, very well academically.
What do you see this time in your life? What do you see in your mind's eye right now?
Oh, just a really happy time. I mean, nice neighborhood, nice people, good friends. Mm-hmm. My father would wear his uniform around town, so he stood out. He was really a good-looking guy.
Yeah.
Looked a lot like Errol Flynn. You know, the mustache and the whole works. Sure. And if you remember those old movies. And he looked real good in his green uniform, and he stood out, so we were kind of celebrities. And we had actually lived somewhere other than Glendale, West Virginia, so we were celebrities in that way. Uh-huh. Had a steady girlfriend, mm-hmm. went to the dances, and mm-hmm. just a happy time.
That's good.
Yeah.
Were you thinking military service at this point?
No, I wasn't thinking more than Friday night, could I get the car? And of course, getting into college and all that kind of
stuff. So your parents were telling you, you know, were they telling you to go to college, or were you saying,
No, that was never an option in our house.
Right.
I mean, it was not something that was discussed. It was like the sun coming up in the morning, you were going to college.
Okay.
I mean, that's just the way it was. That was the way life was. It wasn't discussed. It was just, like I said, it's the way it was.
You think it was a good thing?
I think it was absolutely a great thing. I did the same thing with my girls. We tried to raise them to understand and to think, but I tried not to really give them any choice about two things. One was going to college, and the other was drugs. And as far as I was concerned, those two were not subject to discussion or negotiation. And to the best of my knowledge, both my girls went to college. One graduated, has got her master's, Lynn. Mm-hmm. And to the best of my knowledge, neither one of them ever did drugs. So.
Okay. All right. What kind of, I want to ask this very respectfully. What kind of guy were you in high school? Were you respectful towards your girlfriend? And were you, you know, you were non-sports, right? Non-athletic. So were you, you know, resentful toward the jocks? You know, I want to know about your personality, and then we can talk about how that develops as you go through life.
I was a real respectful kid. All three of us were.
Because of your dad and your mother, which you described earlier.
Yeah, my dad, you know, he had that sense of military discipline, and he had never had much in the way of fathering, so he didn't really have any role models, but he had his idea of what a father should do, and times were different then. And so he was pretty strict. Pretty straightforward. My mom too. Mm-hmm. You know, we were expected to follow the rules, obey the rules. Mm-hmm. We definitely were expected to respect our elders. You know, there's a joke going around now, people my age, mm-hmm. you know, the principal didn't have to whip us. All he had to do was tell the parents, and they'd whip us. And that's a true statement. I mean, people joke about it a lot, but that's a true statement, aside from the fact I was scared to death of our principal.
In West Virginia?
In West Virginia, yeah. Mr. Wiseman.
You haven't forgotten. You're looking like you're still a little tense about it right now.
Well, if you really screwed up, Mr. Wiseman would call you in to give you licks. And I mean, he would lift the football players up off the ground.
Mm. So that worked?
Yeah. It worked.
Okay.
And
how often were you in Mr. Wiseman's office?
The coach got me once, but I was scared to death of him. And I'm sure he was a very nice man, but he was very stern looking and wore the old 1940s suits with the tie that was, you know, 8 inches wide, right. And hit him right about there. My group of friends were, and I don't mean this to sound condescending or anything, but my group of friends were the intellectuals in the school. By that I mean we got the good grades. We were going on to college. And like I say, this is a steel town. You know, people have been working in these mills for 2 and 3 generations. Right. And that's what the kids had to look forward to.
And you weren't thinking, I'm going to a steel factory.
Oh, no. No, that was not even ever in my realm of possibility. For one thing, I knew we'd be leaving.
Right.
You know, so staying there and staying in that lifestyle was never on our horizon at all.
How did you deal with that with your girlfriend? You knew you were taking off. You knew you were A, going to be going to college somewhere. It might be going to Morgan to West Virginia, but you know you're going to be leaving this community, and you know your dad's still in the reserve.
No, he was in the military.
I mean, he's still full time. So how did you deal with that?
Oh, I don't know that we really thought about it a lot. You know, long range planning was the car Friday night.
Right.
And I don't know that we ever really thought about it a lot. It was tough when it was time to leave. He did have a steady girlfriend and everything. But, I got offered a scholarship to WVU. Didn't take it. Often wondered what would have happened if I had.
What was the scholarship in?
Academic scholarship.
Okay.
Like I said, hit really good grades. Mm-hmm. And they came up and recruited a group of us. And I was among that group.
Why didn't you go?
My folks were moving to Texas, and I was kind of immature. I was never real cool or real grown up, real mature, you know. Not one of the in group. So I just never even thought about not living at home and et cetera. So,
okay.
So at least I never really thought about moving that far away.
Okay. So you went with your parents to Texas,
yep.
And did you graduate in Virginia?
My parents did a really great thing for me. My dad got reassigned halfway through my senior year. And rather than yanking me out of school halfway through my senior year, he went down to Texas, back to Fort Sam Houston, and stayed there, and my mother and the three of us kids stayed in West Virginia until I finished high school. And I know that was both a financial sacrifice and a personal sacrifice on their part. And I think it's probably one of the nicest things anybody's ever done for me.
Obviously, it made an impact upon you.
It certainly did. Yeah. And I just thought that was... And it's funny thing is I didn't really even realize it until several years later. Got thinking about it, they did a pretty good thing for me there that they really didn't have to do.
Did you talk to them about it?
I don't think I ever did. Don't think I ever mentioned it to them. And they never mentioned it to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just one of those things.
But now we have it on tape and you can state for the record that it
was a nice thing they did.
Yeah.
Especially since I had to move my daughter before her senior year. Not halfway through, but before her senior year.
Right.
She had a good senior year anyway, but nevertheless, it was tough on her.
Taking a kid out of high school in the middle of the senior year would be very difficult.
Yeah,
it sure would. So where in Texas do you all go?
We go back to San Antonio, to Fort Sam Houston. And my dad stays there about a year and a half after we got there. He'd been there two and a half years.
Mm-hmm. I guess he's still active military.
Still active military. And they tell him he's going to Vietnam. He thinks that two wars per career is probably adequate. And especially after what he went through in Korea, he was not anxious to go again.
How old is he? Is he in his 40s?
In his 40s. Okay. He was born in 1921. And so he's in his mid-40s.
Okay.
His health is not real great.
In what way?
His two things. One is his lungs were so weakened in Korea by the pneumonia that he never really came back from that 100%. And on top of that, he was a very, very heavy smoker. I mean, very heavy smoker. And so between the weakened lungs and that, plus he had a real bad ulcer, which they didn't really know how to treat. And between those three things, his health was, and we didn't realize at the time, but kind of on a downward, mm-hmm. downward trend.
Okay.
But he decided he really didn't want to go to Vietnam.
Well, what position where were they going to assign him? What unit? What type of?
In Vietnam, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, no clue.
Okay.
A lot of times you didn't find out until you got over there.
Right. So they just said, you know,
you're on alert. You're going. And so he said, no, I don't think so. And he retired.
Okay.
And he retired as a major.
Mm-hmm.
And at his retirement ceremony in 1964, he got his Purple Heart from having been shot in 1951.
Really?
Yeah.
Why so long?
At that time, the Army decided that since he was a POW when he had been shot, and what happened was they had the North Koreans had a whole bunch of Americans in marching them along. My dad fell out, and a soldier stood there 15 feet away and fired at him 7 times. My dad countered him, shot at him 7 times and hit him once in the arm. Well, since he was a POW, he technically was not in a combatant status.
Mm-hmm.
So since he wasn't in a combatant status, he was not eligible for a Purple Heart. Well, when Vietnam came around, not a declared war, nothing like that, the guys in Vietnam technically weren't eligible for Purple Heart, so they changed the law. And that made him eligible, and they made it retroactive.
Okay.
So he got his, that's how I understand the story. And so he, that's how he got his Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
20 years later.
You remember that retirement ceremony?
Vividly, yeah.
Proud of him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had done an awful lot with his life.
He had done a lot for his country.
He had done a lot for his country.
How much
and given up a lot for his country.
Yes. How much influence does his military career eventually have upon you? Going into the military and that?
I think not so much on going into the military as the decision to stay in the military. I think he had a lot of influence there. I flunked out of college. We had a good time, though. flunked out of college, was just kind of drifting, you know, pretty typical story, and really no plans, no ideas, no future. And so I did what a lot of kids did those days. I went in the military. You know, I joined the Army. And I couldn't go back to school, so I joined the Army, and that's how I went in.
Okay. Well, and we'll talk about the career for you in post-Vietnam and why you stayed in. Where did you attempt to go to college? Where did you go in? And
I went to Trinity University in San Antonio.
Okay.
And I don't want to say it was wasted time, because it most certainly was not.
Is this 1963 or?
This, I started in 63. I was 17.
Okay.
As I mentioned, not real mature.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Trinity over 3 years. I managed to amass 2 years of credit. But that really helped me out later on. The Army, the chief of staff of the Army, General Westmoreland, said he wanted, made a decision, he wanted all officers to have college degrees. And he put his money where his mouth was, and they started a program called the Undergraduate Degree Completion Program, and a very competitive program. And I was selected, and because I had 2 years of credit, I was eligible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was selected, and I went back and was able to finish my degree.
Okay. What happened to Trinity? I mean, just immaturity and too much fun?
Joined a way too much fun. Joined a fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
Started off great guns. Gosh, I guess I had about a 3.4 my freshman year. But joined that fraternity and discovered parties and having a good time and just really was kind of a complete idiot.
That's pretty honest,
though. But did have a good time. Made some lifelong friends and many of which I still have, are still my friends. And
what fraternity?
It was a local fraternity called Sigma Kappa Epsilon.
Okay.
And it is no longer in existence.
Okay. So, and are these some of the friends from the fraternity?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay. What were your parents thinking as you're kind of going through this process? You're the oldest son, and you're trying to, I guess, they want you to set an example, and you've done so well, up in West Virginia.
Oh, they were pissed. I mean, Trinity is an expensive school.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty upset, not about spending the money, but about the bad grades. And who can blame them? You know, I mean, you can't. They were paying all this money and had all these hopes and expectations, and they were pretty upset. And I, like I say, I really can't blame them at all. Had I been in their position, I'd have felt exactly the same way.
Well, apparently, you were ready for that time, that college.
Yeah,
yes.
I should have never gone at 17. Well, never gone.
So you're there until 1966.
1966, yeah.
Okay.
The spring semester of 66 was my last semester at Trinity. And in September, the day after my 21st birthday, I joined the Army.
Wow. Okay.
So as a private.
Okay. Pat, why don't we take a break?
Sure. No problem.